welcome to our Biz Huddle podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Cuthbert, Creative Director at Baker Creative. If you haven't already subscribed to the channel, please hit subscribe so you can get notified when new content comes out. Please share this with anyone who could be inspired by it.
Melanie Stewart became a justice on the Supreme Court of Ohio in 2019, the first Black woman elected to the position. She previously served as a judge on the 8th District Court of Appeals, where she was the court's administrative judge in 2013. Justice Stewart earned a bachelor's degree in music from the University of Cincinnati, a law degree from Cleveland State University, and a doctorate from Case Western Reserve University. She was previously a member of the faculty of Cleveland State University, the University of Toledo, and Ursuline College. Welcome, Melanie.
Welcome, Justice Stewart. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Who inspired you growing up?
I think I'm unconventional in a way in that regard, and then maybe not so much so. Maybe what I will say will resonate with some people. But I never aspired to do or be anything. And I can't honestly say that I was inspired by anyone or anything to do something specific. So my greatest source of inspiration, as I'm sure it is with a lot of people, in just generally walking through life, was my mother. So my mother, and people who've heard me speak or read anything about me certainly know this story, but my mother was born and raised in the segregated South in Virginia back when Black or Negro children only went up to about the 8th grade, and where she came from, in a little town in Rappahannock County in Virginia. And so after, my mother was one of 11 children. She had 5 older and 5 younger. And so when a child finished going to school up to where he or she could go to school back then, my grandparents sent him or her to go up north and live with a sibling. And most of the siblings, out of the 11 of them, most of them did move out of Virginia, but a few still stayed there. And so my mother came, left there, and went to Washington, D.C., where one of her older sisters were. And so my mother always, you know, craved knowledge and learning. And so she was self-taught in a lot of ways. She read a lot. She wrote poetry. By the time she found her way to Ohio, to Cleveland, she joined the Kiramu Theater, which is historically African-American theater in Cleveland, acting. And that theater was founded in order to allow actors and actresses of color, amateur, to have the opportunity to play in regional, theater. And just to, it wasn't a paid job. Unfortunately, I never got to see my mother act because she stopped just before I was born. But I didn't know, and I should have known, that my mother never even got her high school diploma or GED, and until I finished college, or the same year I was finishing college. And I found that out after she died, and I later found her GED. And I think she got it actually a year before I finished college. But she was always self-taught. She always stressed education. My sister and I both, went to law school. And she never said, be a lawyer, be a doctor, she was just always do the best with where you are, and always leave a place better off than it was when you got there.
So in your past roles as a music teacher and a healthcare administrator, how did that help you with your role today?
I think in everything you do, and because I've had such a diverse background in employment, if you will, you meet people from different walks of life, and you deal with people at different levels of life. So when I taught music, some of my students were children and some were adults. And so that teaches you, for me, how to, and I had to teach differently depending on at what point of their music career they were. Ironically, one of those people I taught as a child is now a law student. and has recently tapped me to be a keynote speaker at a banquet that one of their student organizations is having. So I feel like it's a full circle moment with her. But and then working in the business industry, in the healthcare profession, it was a small healthcare management company. And so I worked directly with the officers of that company, the president and vice president. Ironically, it was the vice president who happened to be in law school part-time when he's working for the company. And I would peruse through his books when he came into the office. And that kind of spurred my interest in going to law school. Even though my sister had a law degree, it was that time. And so I've been privileged to be exposed to a small business, to be in private practice, working for private entities when I worked in the in law academe, and for state universities, government entities, both public and private sectors. So you really get to meet a lot of different people, how they do their jobs, and just the differences in our various industries.
So with your diverse background, what was it about law that kind of attracted you to it?
Well, again, it was really more so after working in the healthcare industry, because as you have probably in my biography, I got my undergraduate degree is in music. Mm-hmm. I got a bachelor's of theory degree, music and composition at the Conservatory of Music at the University of Cincinnati. And as I often jest, because with a name like Melody, what else would I study in undergraduate school? Mm-hmm. And that's all I was really interested in coming out of high school. And I never thought about undergraduate degree, employment, major, you know, profession, being able to support myself. But yeah, that's the only thing I wanted to study. I wanted to know how music worked and the intricacies of it. So I promptly took that degree and got a job in the healthcare industry. I mean, employment opportunities, I wouldn't say abounded, but they were plentiful, as they even are now, but for different reasons. And but after a year doing that, I really just kind of got intellectually bored. So I applied to law school for the intellectual stimulation. And I did spend 3 years of law school saying, do I really want to go to law school? Do I really want to be a lawyer? And so I wasn't sure of the path. I really wasn't a sophisticated person with regard to, did I want to be a litigator? Did I want to be a transactional lawyer? But the class and the knowledge was, all of those things were just interesting. And so it was an intellectual endeavor for me for the most part. And but I'm glad I did, because the knowledge you have as a lawyer is invaluable, and you can do so many different things with your law degree that I don't regret, you know, a single day.
So how was the reaction when you were first elected the first Black woman in your role?
To the Supreme Court. Yes. That was, I've got to tell you, Michelle, that toward the end, that push toward the end to Election Day was so intense. It was mind and body numbing. So by the time Election Day came around, the only thing I wanted to do was, you know, go home and after the polls closed and take a shower and take an Ambien and go to bed, which is my normal routine for elections, because I don't watch election returns, not even for my own election, so, or anybody else's election. So I did not watch the returns. I did not know what was going on. And then when I got a call from my campaign manager that I had indeed, I did refrain from going to bed, and I went downtown to Cleveland for a watch night results. But by the time I got there, he called me and told me that they were going to announced that I was victorious in the election. And I have to tell you, it was not surprising, but it was mind numbing. And when I say it was not surprising, I don't mean to say that in an arrogant way, that I thought I would win or I predicted that I was going to win. I had no prediction whatsoever. And I had no expectation whatsoever that I would definitely win. But I knew going into it that I could win, and it was a possibility. So one of two possibilities existed. I was going to win the election, or I wasn't going to win the election. So neither results would have been surprising to me. And so that's what I mean by it wasn't surprising. And so then it hit, and it was mind-numbing, but then the cameras and the lights were on me, and I was trying not to have my eyes look so peaked, because we had been up for days just for that final push. And I don't think it hit me until I got back to my house about 1:30, 2 o'clock that morning, and sat on the side of my bed and looked at all the text messages, emails, and phone calls that I had gotten. And I think that's when it hit me just how significant the victory was to a lot of people. And that was heartwarming.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice to have the support. I mean, I think other women, I mean, they look at that and they're like, that rocks. I mean, how do you not think that?
Yeah. And for months afterwards, and I have to tell you, as exhausted as I was, I sat there and responded to all of the inquiries that I had on my phone that I could. I wasn't going to call anybody back at 3 or 4 in the morning, but emails and text messages, I responded to every single solitary one of them before I went to bed. And so I finally got in bed about 4:45 that morning. But, you know, I just had to respond then. And then afterwards, then it was just the people sending me notes and sending me letters, and or when I would go certain places. I had a lawyer tell me he was in a CLE when they announced that I had won that next day, and that the whole audience is, you know, some stood up and clapped, and, you know, just those sort of things along the way. And to this day, people who still say to me, you know, I'm so proud of you. And I have to say, no, be proud of us. Nobody gets to where I've gotten by his or herself.
So your first day, you go to work.
Mm-hmm.
Was it surreal? Was it surprising? Anything caught you off guard on that?
No. And let me tell you why. Not that the moment itself wasn't full or wasn't meaningful, but we, Justice Donnelly, Mike Donnelly, who won the same time I won, we had gone down for orientation before we actually, you know, took our seats. There's a lot of preparation and getting ready because hearings were going to start within a few weeks in the beginning of the year. And so as an appellate court judge, I had sat by assignment on the Supreme Court. So let me explain. When a justice has to recuse herself or himself from a case, the Chief Justice appoints one of the 69 Court of Appeals judges across the state to then sit for that justice. So I had sat a couple of times for justices who had to recuse themselves. So sitting on the Supreme Court wasn't novel to me. I wasn't a justice then, I was a justice for the day. But I had been there, I'd sat in those seats, I'd been in that courtroom. And I have to say, the first time I was awestruck by it. So by the time I actually got there and was elected to the court, that aspect wasn't there. But when Justice Donnelly and I came down for orientation, our marshal was showing us around and going through the robe room. And so I went out on the bench with Justice Donnelly, and he was awestruck. And he was a trial court judge, so he never got the opportunity to sit because only appellate court judges do. And just to be with him and witness how awestruck he was like a kid at Christmas time. And he asked our marshal, can I sit in my seat? And the marshal said to him, Justice Donnelly, you can do whatever you want. And he has kept that in mind ever since, being on the bench, doing whatever he wants. So I was grateful that I was able to experience that moment with him.
Oh, that's wonderful. So do you think that women bring a different perspective to the job versus men?
I think some women can. I think all of our perspectives, not just based on our gender or our ethnicity or our cultural background, all of that adds to, you know, who we are and what we bring to the bench. But I think it's important that we're in the room and that we have a seat at the table and that we're there. Even, you know, prior to my election to the court, my election to Justice Donnelly's election, our court was comprised of justices who all belong to the same political party. And I don't think that's a healthy thing for our state, regardless of who the party is. And so we serve our state, our constituents better, I think, when we have diverse perspectives, because we help each other then see things that I think you might not normally see. Prime example, one of the first cases we heard when I got on the bench dealt with a Fourth Amendment search and seizure issue, whether a gentleman who was stopped and frisked when there were shots fired that police were responding to in a general vicinity, whether he should have been stopped and frisked. Now, he had nothing to do with the shooting, and the police encountered him and asked if he heard where the shots were being fired, but he was frisked and asked if he had a weapon. He did have a weapon on him. He told them he did. And he later got, you know, charged with having a weapon without a permit, which of now, of course, is not even a crime in Ohio, but then it was. And I said, when we got into discussions with my colleagues, you know, why was he even searched and stopped? He didn't have any furtive movements. He didn't look suspicious. All he was doing was crossing the streets when the police encountered him. And I said to my colleagues, I don't think a single solitary one of us would have been stopped and frisked, even me. Mm. And because he was a young African-American male, he was. And they didn't have any response to that, because I don't think they could. So just pointing out how citizens are treated differently in those perspectives, and it's all part of our own implicit biases and historical treatment of people in certain communities here. And I am that voice when we're in conferences.
Throughout your career, has there been one case that really was memorable that you're really proud of?
I have been proud to author opinions that I think really help explain a particular law or point out, I think, some deficiencies or some unintended consequences of things. Probably my most proud moments being a judge is a dissent I wrote in a case called State versus Evan King, where unfortunately, writing a dissent, I was in the minority, about someone who had DNA testing, was allowed post-trial DNA, post-conviction DNA testing to prove his innocence. I thought the case was a major travesty of justice and a miscarriage of justice, but more so because even the evidence that was presented, if true, he should not have been convicted of the crime. There was no evidence that proved guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, even though he was convicted. And then after DNA testing was brought about evidence that really showed he was actually innocent of the crime, mm-hmm. his convictions were still upheld. Fortunately, over some subsequent litigation to my being a part of that case and the dissent, he was finally exonerated and released from prison. But I was appalled at how my colleagues who were on the case with me in the Court of Appeals saw the evidence and analyzed the law so much differently than I did. And one of those judges later on, after this gentleman was exonerated, sent me an email that said, "You were right, we were wrong."
Oh, that was kind. Mm-hmm. It opened some eyes.
Oh yeah, it did. And it wasn't, it's never about me. You know, it's never about me. I mean, I am very honored and privileged to do this job, and I was very honored and privileged to be an appellate court judge in Cuyahoga County. And I think I've been educated at some of the best public and private universities in the state. I've had wonderful teachers, not just inside the classroom, outside of the classroom too. I try to learn from every experience and every person. And the fact that I can take all that, you know, collectively to benefit our state, our community, our society is a privilege. And I think it is my responsibility to do so. And so I do so. And then I'm on to the next thing. So I never dwell in, I was right, they were wrong, or they've lost their minds. And I continue to say that you do what you can do, and then you have to move on and leave the rest up to what the universe has in store.
There's an art to that, truly. Kind of like when you won your election, you kind of were ready for either outcome. That is very difficult to do.
Really?
There's a lot of ways things can go, and just kind of keep cool headed. I mean, that's perfect for a judge.
Well, that's a good thing. I try not to let my ego I keep her in check quite often. And not to say that she never arises, but rarely do I see her. And then when I do, I'm, where are you coming from? Yeah.
Right, I hear you. So, what do you think the biggest challenges for the courts in Ohio is?
Wow, there are a lot of them, quite frankly. That would be a whole another podcast. The Ohio courts, we're not a unified court system. And what that means is that we don't speak from the top down. The Supreme Court cannot dictate how all the other courts in the state operate. Each justice and judge of the state is an individually elected person, and he or she does his or her job, the way they feel right to do. So if you're in a smaller county and you're a one judge court at the trial court level, that person has, pretty much free rein of how things operate and run. Now, of course, there are some guidelines. There are rules of superintendence of courts. There are evidentiary rules that have to be followed. We do, as a court, promulgate rules, some of which are have to be signed off on by the General Assembly. And so we've got some parameters in place. It's not totally freewheeling, but we can't make judges and justices do things certain ways. But we do have guidelines and parameters. So there are certain timelines we have, or guidelines for how many cases should go through your, how long they should linger in your court. And those sort of things. And we look to the judges and the administrative judges of the court to kind of keep a rein on that. But certainly some of our most, I think, problematic challenges are efficiency, effectiveness, access to the courts. We're still, even in 2023, I think some things are still antiquated. We saw those quite a bit when COVID hit, when the pandemic hit, and the Supreme Court had to dole out, millions of dollars in technology grants just to get some courts able to have electronic filing or to have remote hearings, because some courts in our state didn't have that. Some are obviously, way ahead of the game. And so it is that feature. And it is, I think, too, for us as an entire judicial system, it's remembering that we're here to serve the citizens, the organizations, the businesses, the governmental entities of our state. We're here to adjudicate, take cases, and get matters resolved, preferably as quickly as possible, and expedite those things through the system. And so it can't be about us. It's got to be about the parties. It's got to be about, the individuals. And so, and we count on our members of the bar to help with that. And we count on citizens too, to be on some of our commissions that have non-lawyer membership involved, and listening and calling us and emailing us and lodging complaints where there should be complaints, as opposed to being fearful of whether a judge will retaliate. And so we just have to be better at having parameters in place so that overall our judicial system works the best it can work for everybody.
What's the biggest mistake you see other women business owners or women in business in general make?
For me, and this is just my personal opinion, I am often disappointed, I'll say, when I see a woman, particularly in leadership position, who feels, who I know personally, and who feel that they have to be more like the men in the position in order to be respected or to have some credibility. My personal opinion is that does a disservice to women in general. It does a disservice to her talents and her strengths. But I realize that some women feel that's necessary because that's how society views people in leadership positions, or people at the head of things. As I even mentioned in the panel discussion we had with the preview of the documentary last week. Yes, a lot of women are in the judiciary. I remember running for Court of Appeals and being somewhere and handing my literature to someone, and to a man, and the man just said, "I'm voting for you because you're a woman." And I think women make better judges. And I thought, okay, well, I'm glad you're voting for me. But, there can be women who are not so good at something, just like there are men, they're not so good at something too. But so it's okay. And it's become acceptable for women to be judges, maybe even preferable, just as we have, women who are prominent in the teaching field and the nursing fields, so much so that, people would sometimes say a male teacher or a male nurse, as if you have to designate, because that's strictly a female category. Now, I think for judges, although there still might be some bias toward men in that role, there's so many women who are on the bench now. But we don't have a lot of women in elected executive positions. Well, I don't know if we have any women mayors we do. I happen to know some. Hopefully they won't see this. But we have few women who are elected mayors of cities across the state. Obviously, we only had a woman governor for a short period of time when Nancy Hollister was governor. So it's still, I think, some sort of hesitancy to believe that women can be in leadership roles and lead as effectively as men. And so in that regard, we're always behind the eight ball in trying to convince people that we have the know-how to do a job. Now, if the job entailed strength and speed and running or something like that, I would probably, pick a 25-year-old able-bodied male over me for speed and strength, but involving intellect and building consensus and doing what's right for on behalf of the community, men don't have a advantage over women, in my opinion.
So what are the next steps for you? What is your vision for the next 10 years?
I don't know. We have 6-year terms. I'm up for re-election in 2024. And, I've got to decide whether I'm run for re-election, and that sounds strange because I'm not age barred, as you cannot run for a judicial seat in Ohio if you will be age 70 before that term starts. I am not age barred. As a matter of fact, on that rule, I could run two more times. But the political landscape has changed. Last year was the first time that the voters in Ohio saw partisan affiliation on the ballot in the general election for Supreme Court justices and appellate court judges, not any of the other judges. So that's an interesting differential. And I will just be frank and say, I think that is certainly politically motivated in an attempt to favor one party over the other. And I am disadvantaged by that rule change. And so I've got to figure out whether, running statewide is a huge undertaking. It's an expensive undertaking. And I need to figure out whether it makes sense for me to run for re-election. And I'm not afraid of losing. I've lost elections before, so that's not an issue. But just whether it makes sense to do that, or is there some other candidate who would be better at doing it, whether I do something else, whether my time on the Supreme Court is done and it's time for me to be redirected to do something else, or whether I retire and sit home and play the piano and compose music. So those are decisions I have to make soon.
So when it's all said and done, mm-hmm. This could be either personally or professionally, what kind of legacy would you like to leave?
I'd like for people who only know me professionally to say that she was a good public servant. And for people who know me in both endeavors, personally and professionally, they say she was a good public servant and she was a great person.
Hey, you can't ask for more than that.
Can't ask for anything more. That would be my legacy will be complete.
And I do recognize that when I watch the film that you're in and others, I see that spirit of resilience throughout of it. And I think that is awesome. I mean, it's just so inspiring to see that. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate your time and doing the interview. And thank you so much.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Have a good rest of the week.
If you haven't already subscribed to the channel, please hit subscribe so you can get notified when new content comes out. Please share this with anyone who could be inspired by it, and feel free to post any questions so we can be inspired by new content. Thanks for listening. If you're interested in learning more, visit our website at bakercreative.co.